Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves. And we have one of our favorite guests back to join us today. This is Mark Dunn, Executive Vice President from the American Kennel Club. And Mark is going to give us an update on what we call the AKC U.S. Detection Dog Task Force. That's a lot of hard consonants there, man. So welcome. I appreciate you joining us, Mark.
Thank you, Laura. It's a pleasure to be here. It's always fun to talk to you. And I appreciate the chance to share this with your audience.
Excellent. So we've talked a little bit about this before. So for listeners, I'll give you a link to our first time we talked about this, but this is an update. So give us a quick rundown, kind of the background for people that haven't listened to that previous episode, and then let's kind of catch up with where you guys are now.
Sure. You know, some people, when they first hear about this, they're like, what's the problem? You know,
right.
Why is this a concern? Why do I need to worry about this? And you have to think about what's happened in our world since 9/11 in particular, where there are people that want to attack our society and change the way we live our lives. And unfortunately, they've had some level of success. Of course, 9/11 was a wake-up call, but just even in the last few years, if you think about the Boston Marathon, the Chelsea bombing, the Ariana Grande concert in Manchester in England, and then even most recently, I believe in December of 2017, we had a man try to blow himself up in the tunnel approaching the transit lines in New York City.
Right.
So because of those incidents and what's happening in the world, there is a growing demand for dogs that can help protect us. And that demand isn't just driven by the military and the police. There are hundreds of thousands of companies and organizations that are also seeking out either dogs to help join their security forces or contractors that can play that role. So universities, venues like arenas, and you have major sports leagues like Major League Baseball, hockey, NFL, are all requiring now that there be detection dogs to clear the event before the people arrive and also to work the crowd.
Right.
And the problem is, you know, to get to the real problem is almost all of these dogs are coming from Eastern Europe. The sources we've talked to in the U.S. government and the private contractors who source these dogs all agree that 80 to 90% of the dogs that are coming in to do this important work are coming from the Ukraine, Belarus, Czech Republic, Bulgaria, and the whole world shops in these same countries to get these dogs. So the demand around the world has skyrocketed, not just the United States. So in many cases, we're trying to outbid Saudi Arabia or Israel or Indonesia to buy dogs from these brokers and kennels in Europe. And the sad thing is, or the interesting thing from AKC's perspective, is the demand for these dogs, because they're trying to find dogs that can work around lots of general public. They want dogs like Labrador Retrievers and Vizslas and German Wirehaired Pointers,
right.
German Shorthaired Pointers that can work around the public, and yet they're trying to buy those dogs in Europe instead of buying them right here in the U.S.
Yeah, and I think that that was the fascinating piece to me, is that the AKC has been working on and the potential to develop a breeding program in our country for dogs to protect our country using purpose-bred, responsibly bred dogs.
Right. I mean, it's one thing to think of, or to understand, I guess, why the military looks to Eastern Europe for dogs to do what they call patrol work, or mm-hmm. what we might call bite work.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're looking for the German Shepherd or the Malinois that comes from a line of successful Shih Tzu dogs, and where there's the kind of genetics and the drive that is useful or most appropriate for that kind of work, that kind of makes sense why they go to Europe for those dogs. And unfortunately, the bias that exists, particularly in the military's buying patterns and TSA and the U.S. government, and to some degree, police departments in the U.S., because they always got their pointy-eared dogs, their Malinois right. and their Dutch Shepherds and their German Shepherds from over there, when they needed a Labrador Retriever, they went to the same brokers. They right. go to the same places. And that's what's alarming, is that we're dependent on not the best sources for not the best dogs. We know the best sporting breeds in the world are right here in the U.S. The best sporting lines are here in the U.S. We have the dogs with the drive and the skills. We have the breeders that can create these dogs. But we just have to find a way to bridge this gulf between our breeders, AKC breeders that breed these breeds, and the people that are training and deploying these dogs to do this important work.
And so that's the nub of what I wanted to talk about today. I mean, we know that these, you call them, I thought it was so cute, floppy-eared dogs, right? The sporting breeds are less intimidating, right? When you're out in a public space and you're working through the crowd at Disneyland, a lab or a wire hair is a whole lot less scary than a pointy-eared dog. We know that part. So what are we working toward here with the American Kennel Club? How is that working? How is that bridge coming together?
We were originally approached by people in the government to help solve the problem. And the American Kennel Club board formed the task force with a few board members led by Dr. Carmen Battaglia and some staff members, including me, Doug Lundgren, Sheila Goff, and a few other people, to help figure out how can we make a difference. So there are people out there that think we can do something, but what can we do? So we spent some time talking to what we call all the stakeholders, people in the U.S. government, people in the police departments, people that certify police dogs, lots of academics, University of Pennsylvania, Dr. Cindy Otto at Penn Vet Work Dog Center has worked in this space for a while, has a lot of understanding of why things are the way they are and what needs to change. But we also spoke with Auburn University and some other universities that have been active in doing research and trying to find ways to improve the quality of working dogs. The answer we got from everyone is that U.S. breeders don't raise dogs for anyone but themselves. With few exceptions, do U.S. breeders raise dogs to 10 or 12 months and then try to sell them. So there are some hunting lines and some great field trialers that may be selling partially trained or fully trained dogs, but that's the exception. For the most part, people breeding Labrador Retrievers are going to sell them when they're 8 or 10 weeks old.
Right.
And the government and the people buying these dogs are looking for 10 or 12-month-old dogs.
Right.
And it's not just a dog that's lived in a kennel for 10 or 12 months. They need a dog that is ready to go and do this work. They may not know how to find a bond yet, but they need the other key skills. They need to have a high hunt drive, and they have to be very environmentally stable. They have to have been exposed to lots of different noises and people and moving objects and moving stairwells and all sorts of kind of environmental stimulus, so that this puppy grows up to be a very environmentally stable, confident, and capable dog. And that's what's missing right now in the U.S. And we see that as the opportunity for the AKC through breeder education, breeder outreach, and working with parent clubs and other organizations to find a way to set up a model puppy raising program.
Right.
That can help teach people how to do this well.
Right. And I think that's the key, is two factors from what you're saying. Show people what they need to do, right? Like, there's puppy raising criteria from all of these different organizations, Penn Vet, obviously, and then talk to people who are willing to do that. I just think it's got so much potential, and I would love to know how that's coming along. And you mentioned something a little bit earlier off air about a conference you have this August, I guess. Are we going to get to hear more there?
Absolutely. So over the last few months, our focus has been to meet with, to collaborate with, and to also to bring together these different entities that have a strong interest and knowledge regarding how to develop a domestic supply of explosive detection dogs. The one thing we heard from everyone who's tried to do this is that the key is purpose-bred, purpose-raised, and purpose-trained. So, of course, we believe in purpose breeding and purposeful, thoughtful, purebred breeding. So we start off in the right place. And I mentioned this issue of breeders or puppy raisers needing to learn how to do what it takes to create this dog that's going to be able to go and be successful in this area. The key then, as you pointed out, is to teach people how to do that. The conference we're putting together is our second. Last year we did our first conference. It was more of a stakeholders meeting. We had about 50 attendees from government, academia, some trainers, and just a few people from the breeding world that attended. This year, we're holding it in August, on August 28th, 29th, and 30th in Raleigh. We've already maxed out the attendees. We had room for 150 attendees, and we reached that a few weeks ago. Although there is a wait list, it's building now. Mm-hmm. You can learn more about it on AKC.org. If you go to AKC.org under other resources, you'll see the Detection Dog Task Force listed. You can learn more about what we're doing, and you can sign up for the conference there. But while we're there, we will have people that are experts in dog and canine intelligence. We have experts in raising dogs for working jobs. Mm-hmm. And we have experts in from academia on how genetics plays a role in this, how scent can be introduced to dogs, and how early scent work can make a difference mm-hmm. in a dog's ability to be successful. But it's an amazing group with people from the FBI, from Department of Homeland Security, from the Department of Defense, NC State University, Auburn University, PennVet, and Purdue. We have Candace Coney from Purdue speaking, plus people from the world of training detection dogs mm-hmm. that can help both people on the supply side of the equation understand what they need to be successful, what they need to do to be successful in creating dogs that can go on and do this work. The other thing, Laura, I think is really exciting here is that if we can make a difference in the domestic supply of these dogs, then we help protect our country. And we're not talking about millions of dogs. They need a few thousand dogs a year to move mm-hmm. into this kind of work. And I think if you think about the sheer number of dogs and breeders that we have in the United States, that finding a way to find these 2,000 or 3,000 dogs capable of filling these roles and being successful will help protect our country. But I think the reason we're really excited about it is that it's a great example of how purposeful, thoughtful breeding by American breeders can help protect our country. And that kind of message, that story mm-hmm. about the important role that breeders play in our lives, an important role that purposeful breeding and thoughtful breeding of purebred dogs, what that means to our country, that reflects well on all breeders, not just on Labrador Retrievers and German Short-Haired Pointer breeders, but on Chihuahua breeders and Bichon breeders and Miniature Poodle breeders, that all breeders who responsibly, thoughtfully, and purposefully breed purebred dogs for the American public, for whatever that job is, whether the job is to be a companion or an explosive detection dog, that the same processes, the same steps go into play. And that's why we should be celebrating breeders in this country and not denigrating them. So that's the ultimate opportunity for us here and why this project, I think, is so important to the AKC and to our breeders.
Hang tight, guys. Got a little bit of information for you. We'll be right back to the podcast in a minute.
How much is that dog in the window?
Okay, crew. I hear it pretty much every day now. I love Pure Dog Talk, and that makes my heart happy, because I love doing it. I started hosting Pure Dog Talk as a way to reach out to members of our community with education and resources to enable you to succeed and move forward in your goals and ambitions. And your response has been literally overwhelming. The podcast has been downloaded well over 250,000 times to date. That's incredible. All of this information is free to exhibitors around the world at the touch of a button. But here's the reality check. Money really does make the world go round, guys. So I created a special patrons group. This funding source helps cover the expenses of audio editing and website hosting and technology and like that. Patrons keep Pure Dog Talk's fountain of knowledge flowing freely. And like the NPR of dogdom, our patrons support Pure Dog Talk with monthly gifts. We even offer advertising and sponsorship opportunities that you guys may not have known about. So drop me a note, laura@puredogtalk.com, and I'll let you know how you can help share the love.
How much is that
Well, and I think, too, you made an interesting point, again, when we were talking a little bit earlier, that these dogs that are purpose-bred, purpose-raised, and purpose-trained, that's what you need, that the taking a dog from an animal shelter or something like that, well, it sounds nice in theory. Talk about the costs and some of the things that are associated with that, why it is so much more important to have this dog that's raised and trained in this way.
You know, there's a group called Canine Companions for Independence.
Yes.
CCI. And their long-term leader, who retired from the organization recently, but Paul Mundell led that group for a long time and helped set up their breeding program. You know, he is on the record saying that they tried to use shelter dogs, that many of the people who donate to the group and are great benefactors for CCI encouraged and expected that they would make use of shelter dogs for that kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that, yes, it is possible to find a shelter dog that can be successful doing this work, but that the recipe for success is purpose-bred, purpose-raised, and purpose-trained. You know, there's a great example. I think I used it when I spoke to you last time or when we were together at the NAIA conference last year. But there's a dog out in San Francisco area that was rescued from a shelter that is now a sewage detection dog. And it's a very, very successful sewage leak detection dog. Also an AKC agility champion.
Right.
Has a great trainer and a great owner who rescued this dog and was able to harness some of his natural abilities and then train the dog to be very successful as a sewage leak detection dog. That dog would probably be a great explosive detection dog as well.
Right.
But the problem is, you know, the needle in the haystack of, you know, going through the shelter and trying to find the dogs that can do this and knowing that there's a fairly high washout rate even for some of the purpose-bred dogs. So, again, the people who do this for a living, who are trying to meet this need today, both around the world, are looking for dogs that started out with the right genetics and then had the right early life, you know, whether it's early neurological stimulation, early socialization, and then, you know, this idea of creating this dog with a strong hunt drive, with a high environmental stability, and the ability to be basically unfazed by loud noises, by strange things going on, alert to a change, but then go back to work, get
right.
the job done, keep hunting for the whatever it's supposed to be hunting for in order to get its reward.
Right. And one of the points in here in your information that you sent that I'd really love to touch on a little bit because it's fascinating to me, you're talking about establishing a database that includes genotyping and phenotype information and certifications that measure capability. Is that something that's actually in place or in development at this point?
Well, so...
I'm sorry, that's the one that caught my eye. It fascinates me.
I know. So the AKC board has approved staff to work on this kind of idea of networking and collaboration and to put together the conference. This will be the second year we've done the conference.
Right.
And also to explore other ways that we can make a difference and how to leverage some of our capabilities. Well, one of our really strong capabilities is database. You know, AKC has millions and millions of dogs in its database. We have 6 million genetic profiles in our database. We have tens of millions of AKC registered dogs and mixed breed dogs and PAL dogs in our database. It is kind of a core competency. It's the center of what AKC's proprietary knowledge is all about.
Right.
So we are talking to existing organizations on how we can help them pull this together, how the AKC can leverage its ability to manage a database, to create the interfaces needed to be successful, so that the dogs being raised for this work can be entered into the database at an early stage in their life, hopefully with permanent identification in place, like which involved genotyping for parentage, so they can be tracked across their whole working life. So that we know that dogs that were intended for this work, how did they turn out? Like, where did they come from? Who were their parents? What were their early experiences? On the phenotype side, whether it's health issues, understanding their OFAs, their other phenotype health information, but also their certifications, their U.S. police canine certification, their other factors from their working life, so that we can start to paint a picture of what works and what doesn't work. unfortunately, you would think this would already exist, but it doesn't.
Wow.
Most of the dogs that work for the government, there is no single place to go to learn all this information.
Huh.
And many dogs out there working every day, in many cases, there's not even a pedigree. They can't always even relate the fact that this dog turned out really good, but we have no idea who its parents were. We don't know who the sire was of this dog. Therefore,
seriously,
it's impossible to try to. Absolutely true. There is a gentleman named Scott Thomas I would love for you to interview sometime. Scott used to run the TSA breeding program, and he is now acting as a consultant to the American Kennel Club as we go down this path to find how we can best help. And Scott talks about, you know, his time at the U.S. government and the lack of information, both being collected at when the puppies or the dogs first entered the program, but the lack of information on their progress as they moved through either within TSA or if they were deployed through the military, that there's just a void and no real attempt to follow those dogs through their life to really track the quality of their life and to keep on top of their welfare and the situation that they have for their entire life, even after they're done doing the job.
Right. And we assume that part of the process here is to establish an actual retirement program so that when the dog is finished with its work, it goes to a retirement home.
Right. You know, that's a real concern. And it's one of the concerns that some of the parent clubs brought to our attention. You know, I met with the Labrador Retriever Club about a month ago out in Oregon, and they're very excited about what's happening there and very proud, of course, of the role that Labrador Retrievers are playing in protecting our country. But they had concerns about what happens to the dogs that don't make it and what happens to these dogs when their useful working life comes to an end. And it's a great concern. And that's where, you know, a database that can track, you know, using permanent identification, a dog's entire life arc is really important. There are contracts, you know, the government writes contracts and hires contractors, and I can't speak to how the NFL or the NBA or some venue, how they find dogs and contractors to do this work, but many of these contracts have clauses about the welfare of the animals.
Right.
And about their disposition, if you will, when they're done working.
Correct.
The military does a really good job of staying on top of this. They had a miscue a few years ago, about 5 years ago, and Inspector General did a pretty scathing report on this one project that they ran where they didn't maintain tight control and tight oversight of where they went after they were done with the project.
Right.
So I think the military, in speaking with them, they learned their lessons from that, and their contracts are really clear on this. But I always ask them, how do they know? Like, how do they know that the contractor is meeting the obligation? And I believe strongly that permanent DNA identification may be the secret, that if there is a doubt, if there's a dog and someone believes that the dog was not properly maintained and that whoever was in charge of it, whether it be a government agency or a contractor, failed in their duty, that it could be proven. If we had collected the DNA when the dog was first bred for the program, and then later, if there was a question, you could prove it through DNA that, yes, the government failed in this case, or maybe this is a mistake and the dog is not related to the program. Right now, it's a little hazy on how that's going to turn out.
Yeah. So I know when we first talked about this the first time, several comments that I saw come through in response to the topic, that was a primary feature of those comments, was why am I going to breed up my puppy and then the government's going to do bad things with it when it's done, sort of thing, you know? So I can say for sure that was my experience as well in terms of what people thought about this.
You know, I think that's the reason why it's important that AKC play the role we're playing in this, is no one's really answered that question well yet, but it's a question that has to be asked.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a question that our parent clubs and our fanciers are asking. And I feel like with the leadership role that AKC is playing in this project, that we can get those sort of things in place. There should be a way that I can breed a dog, I can raise this dog for the kind of work we're talking about, to go and work for the TSA to make sure that our airports and our airplanes are safe. And I shouldn't have to worry about what's going to happen to that dog when it's 6 years old or 7 years old and is retired from the work. I should have a say in that matter. You know, I should be able to produce this dog, have it go into that service, and then have some sort of first right of refusal on its disposition later, right? So will it go to its handler, which is often what happens with military dogs and police dogs. They often retire with their handler. But if there's any doubt on that, then as a breeder, I would want that knowledge, and I would want to be able to play a role in that dog's future. So if we can work that out.
Yeah. Think about every responsible breeder I know, including my contract. It says, if at any time you cannot keep this dog any longer, it comes back to me. Right. So that is built into our mindset as breeders. And I would think that if there was a way to incorporate that kind of first right of refusal language, that's going to assuage a lot of people's concerns.
Right. Yep. Especially selling to private contractors or to local governments. We all can look at the federal government and wish that they did certain things better. But in my talks with the TSA, with DOD people, Army Research Office, and others, that the dogs retiring from the military and U.S. government work are tracked well in that regard. And in the problem they had, and there was this Inspector General's report that was issued on a particular contract from about 5 years ago for one small program, and they didn't get that disposition language correct. And that program had a small problem, and there were some dogs that should have gone to their military handlers that didn't, and so questions were asked. So I think the federal government has a better handle on it. I worry more about the private contractors that may have boom and bust cycles, that may have a big contract, get a bunch of dogs, and then have the contract terminate and suddenly have some excess.
Mm-hmm.
The good news there is, in general, if the dog is within its working life, there is so much demand for those dogs that they're well-treated because they're important to getting the job done. But the retirement dogs is probably where there's more of a question. But again, if we're talking about, you know, Labrador Retrievers and Pointers and perhaps even some Spaniels and Vizslas and some other breeds, 6 years old is still a great age for an adoption, for a dog to go into a pet home. And so I don't know that there's a welfare problem at all, but I believe that we can do things to minimize the chance of a welfare problem and also to make sure breeders feel good about participating in this.
Right.
Because otherwise we'll be stuck getting our dogs from some Bulgarian kennel, you know, or Ukrainian kennel, because American breeders don't want to participate.
Right.
We have to cross that. We have to fix that concern.
Yep. I think that's an excellent one. Okay. Well, Mark, thank you so very much for bringing us an update on this. I will make sure people have resources, and I will look forward to the August conference and what we might be able to pull together on that and share with our listeners. So
it'll be great to have you out there, Laura, if you can make it. And I'm sure there will be at least half a dozen opportunities to interview some people that really know a lot more than I do about this subject, but they can talk about specifically, you know, their corner of this world.
Right.
And also how important American breeders are to helping us solve the supply issues.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you, Mark. You have a great day.
Thank you, Laura.
All right, crew, welcome back to our Tips of the Week with Allison Foley from the Leading Edge Dog Show Academy. How are you doing today, Allison?
I'm great today, Laura. How about you?
Spectacular.
Excellent.
So today's tip is an absolute, can I have an amen, hallelujah, preach, sister. Where we place the leash or collar when moving the dog.
That's right. So I think this started as a conversation between you and I about, you know, we get a puppy from a breeder or a client or a friend, and they show its relative or its something on a certain kind of leash, like maybe a Resco, maybe a slip collar, maybe a martingale. And we kind of get married to the idea that we need to do that too.
Right.
So, you know, I think if you're having problems or the dog isn't showing exactly how you want, I think it's important to switch up the lead, even if you're going towards a leash or a collar that you don't eventually want to use. Sometimes you just have to step out of your comfort zone in order to get there.
Mm-hmm.
But even more importantly than that, which you and I have discussed, is the placement of the lead, especially on a young, young dog. So we show a lot of our dogs with the leash coming off on the offside of the dog, like up beside the cheek or the ear. and it looks really pretty and you can loosen the lead and the dog can really move out. But on the same token, we see a lot of young dogs that are fighting this. They're sidewinding. They're looking up at the lead, up at you, because the lead is in an unnatural position
right.
for them.
They're chewing on the leash. They're playing with it, whatever.
They're pawing at it with their paw as they go on the down and back.
Yes.
So people, and Laura, you can chime in as soon as I'm done, put the leash on the top of their head, between their ears. I don't care if it's a golden retriever. I don't care if it's a pug. I don't care if it's a poodle and you're putting it in the middle of that top knot. Put it in the middle of the top knot. Give the dog a straight arrow down to its body so its body can then go straight down to the ground instead of always being in this kind of C shape as it's learning how to walk on a leash.
Yes, preach. Hallelujah. Amen. Chorus here. This is one, and we were talking about this earlier, Allison, truly and legitimately, every single time I see somebody with a dog that can't move right, I say, here, you put the collar or the resco or whatever it is, and you center it on the occiput, right? Straight in the middle of its head. And by golly, look at there. That dog can walk in a straight line.
Exactly. And people are always looked at you like you have seven heads. Like, no, I could never do that because that's not how you show them. Well, eventually, maybe you don't have to show it like this. But for now, this is going to help.
Yeah. Training our dogs to walk in a straight line frequently involves giving them a straight line to follow.
Very good. I love that. Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Allison, thank you so much. As always, your tips are inspiring, and I know that our listeners love them. Listeners, don't forget Pure Dog Talk 25, and now Leading Edge Dog Show Academy has a subscription service. Yes, Allison?
Yes, Laura. So you can use your Pure Dog Talk 25 discount for 25% off, and you will access every single video, 500 videos, PDFs, cheat sheets, workbooks, etc. in the school, all yours. Just, it's like the Netflix of dog shows. Here we go, people. So we would love to have you.
Hey, you are the Netflix. I'm the NPR. I love this.
There you go. Look at us.
Go, girl. All right. Thanks so much, Allison. You have a great day.
You have a nice day, too, Laura.
The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.